is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Alexa Lazovchuk, and it's so much fun to have a chance to talk with you again.
Always a pleasure, Kate.
And since we talked, you have picked up just a bunch of awards for your music for Dead Rising 4, and so I'd love for you to just, you know, kind of hit the highlights.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's been a great year. It's kind of weird because we released the game last year, and then there's a new version that just came out now with additional sections. So, and usually the way awards work is they happen 6 months later or a year later. But yeah, it was great. We got a Hollywood Music and Media Award for Best Trailer for Film, TV, and Games for Coldest Time of Year. And then got a Global Music and Sound Award also for that same trailer. And then I think a Gang Award nomination for Best Vocal Pop Song for O Willamette. And a couple others as well. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
That's fantastic. It's so great to get this soundtrack recognized, too. Well, it's Christmas time, and I guess that means it's time to head back to that small Colorado town of Willamette with Frank West to do a little shopping at the mall, right?
I mean, I guess, yeah. It was funny. Yesterday we did a Twitch stream, and I didn't realize, like, some people actually, not everybody, but some people actually thought of Dead Rising 4 as that kind of like Die Hard, where it's like, you know, there's not that many zombie games that take place at Christmas time and stuff, so it's kind of neat that they associate the Christmas aspect of the game experience with some of the music that we made for it. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I've been driving around listening to the Christmas songs that you wrote for DR4 as a little playlist in the car, which I think is, if you're not playing the game, probably the perfect way to listen to them. And you've mentioned that writing those songs was one of your favorite parts of working on the DR soundtrack. And why was that?
100%. It was one of the most fun things. It was a combination. I think it's just, hey, it's Christmas tunes, and it's basically working within genres that are a lot of fun. Like, you can't create that kind of stuff and be like on a downer, you know. There's a lot of swagger to it. There's a lot of energy, a lot of fun with it. So working on, I mean, I got to work on with jazz trios or quartets and even big band. And I mean, we did Bollywood stuff as well.
Yeah, that's nuts.
And country. And so it was nice to have a theme which everybody resonated with and had their own associations with the holiday time of the year or Christmas. But then being able to then just literally on the fly, you're just like, oh, well, why don't we do this? Or why don't we do this? And you know, it was totally an empty canvas, and we could just fill it accordingly.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. Good tidings. Good tidings we bring to you and your kin. Good tidings for Christmas and a happy new year. Bring us some figgy pudding. Oh, bring us some figgy pudding. Bring us some figgy pudding and a cup of good cheer. Until we get some. We won't go till we get some. No, we won't go until we get some. So you better bring some out here. Go get some and bring some out here. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Happy New Year.
Yeah, and it's such an interesting blend of different styles, and you know, a lot of them have that kind of mid-20th century Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby sound, Gene Autry with Rudolph, which makes them really nostalgic. So how did you decide that that was one of the styles that was going to work really well with the game?
You kind of nailed it on the head. It was basically, we were kind of going for that golden era Hollywood 40s, 50s, 60s sound. in terms of Frank Sinatra and Mel Torme and, like you said, Bing Crosby and whatnot, it was lush orchestrations. Everybody associates Christmas time with a certain feeling, right? Fireplace or the smell of pine or snow coming down for the first night as you're looking through store shops, looking at, you know, the presents that you want to get as a kid or just time with family. So I just basically looked at, you know, what Christmas songs are still in the public domain that we could use without eating up all of our music budget. And essentially, I just partnered with Robert L. High. He's one of the world's top orchestrators. He works with everybody from Danny Elfman to Brian Tyler to you name it, and a couple other people, and just kind of literally created a list of like 20 to 40 different songs. And then once we had narrowed down the actual Christmas songs that we thought we would hit, then I would figure out the keys, the structures, the type of arrangements, the type of songs, like doing a Duke Ellington version of this versus somebody else, you know, some other jazz legend's version of this. Those are quite different in their approach. And we were working with jazz musicians, both in the country of Georgia, but also Braxton Cook and his jazz quartet out of New York. They also had their own flavor as well. So once we mapped out kind of like, okay, well, we need kind of a couple of Frank Sinatra-ish kind of things here, a couple of Bing Crosby here. We need a bit of flavor of this. Then it was just a matter of laying them out and basically just starting to go through them. And usually it was inspiration based. So if I'd get to work or get to the session and be like, okay, well, I feel like singing or doing this. And he would basically roll the tape and track and then build up the track around that. Other times it was, we would get lead charts that we would make up for a couple of the jazz trios or quartets with some demos that I would do for them to give them kind of direction. And then we would put it up in front of the players and let them do their thing. And then there was usually quite an involved post-production process where I would find all the different singers, like the crooners of the different, you know, people that could sound like certain people. I would find them all over. We'd build up the track, send them. I would mock sing it myself for them to give them an idea of what I wanted them to do. They'd do their thing. We would then maybe get some overdubs of like horn. We do a horn session maybe with some four saxes and flugelhorns and trumpets and stuff. And then we would fire it off and get live drums done in New York with another drummer and then bring it back and edit and then put it all together, send it off to a couple of mixers, or I'd mix it myself, finalize it with mastering just to make sure it had that great scene. And that's how you ended up with the song. So there was a lot that was done, but because the material was so much fun and because I tried to involve as many people as possible, it was totally worth it.
Snow, it makes you move fast. Glow, it makes your heart dash. Don't have much that's left. Now why don't you follow me? Sleigh ride with me tonight, babe. Across the silver moon, it's just me and you. Sleigh ride, joy ride, time to blow it open wide. Why don't you sleigh ride with me? Toys, there's so much left to grab. Joy, it's something to be had. Time to make your one last wish. It's now or never. I'd love for you to come and sleigh ride with me tonight, babe. Across the silver moon, it's just me and you. Sleigh ride, joy ride, time to blow it open wide. Why don't you sleigh ride with me? Fire, it makes you feel alive.
cold. It won't stop me tonight from chasing you around the whole wide world. Why don't you come on and sleigh ride with me tonight, babe? Across the silver moon, it's just me and you. Sleigh ride, joy ride. Why don't you sleigh ride with me?
Oh, yeah, and they sound like they could have been written in the 40s and 50s and 60s, which just gives such a great, as you mentioned, kind of a sheen and a real polish and a sense of time and place for Willamette, too. And as I was listening to them earlier, I was thinking, you know, not all of the singers were native English speakers. And so I'm kind of wondering what it must have been like to explain, you know, because in some of these carols, there are really obscure words, like trolling the ancient Yuletide carols and stuff. So did you have any kind of a language barrier when you were explaining to them what the meaning of the songs was?
Well, thankfully, I think for the most part, most of the Christmas ones, either I performed or we had English-speaking people that performed those Christmas ones. What we tried to do, because there was only, I think there was only 6 or 7 public domain Christmas songs that were secular, that weren't sacred, because we didn't want to mix that. And so being restricted, there was kind of a threshold where we could only do 3 versions of O Christmas Tree or 4 versions of
Oh, there's a few different versions of Deck the Halls.
Yeah, Deck the Halls, right? So we would do like a jazzy trio version of Deck the Halls or quartet. Actually, I sang on that one, actually, and I tried to channel some Tony Bennett, basically, right? but then we did Auld Lang Syne, let's say, and that one we had in-house, one of our project managers. He's from the UK, and I was like, I got to get you in and to sing on this. Although it's not Christmas, it's still holiday kind of stuff. But what we found was that there's only so many versions of those five or six public domain Christmas songs. We had to complement them with others. So what we did was I trolled through other songs around pre-1923 public domain songs that could kind of fit in terms of just the overall vibe and the spirit of the festive kind of material. And those ones were the ones where I was able to work with people who didn't speak English. And I mean, it was an interesting process because like Tamta, she sang, so this, for example. So like a song like Ain't We Got Fun, which I think Peggy Lee originally did. Tamta, who is a singer out of the country of Georgia. I was YouTubing different Georgian artists and jazz artists and other people. And I heard her voice. I'm like, wow, she's got a great kind of, she harkens that kind of feeling. And so I was like, okay, well, let's get her to go. Well, once we hooked it up and set up the session and did everything, it became apparent very quickly that language was going to be a barrier in terms of, you know, because a lot of times when you're producing vocals and you're working with artists or you're doing it yourself, transactions that take place are very nuanced, and just changing inflection of a syllable or a word or the way you lilt going up or coming down or the dynamics, those are all kinds of things which you tweak if you're not doing a live recording and you're doing kind of a produced vocal recording on its own. There's a lot of back and forth there to get exactly where you want to be. And we didn't have that luxury working with some of the Georgian artists, A, because of time, but mostly because we didn't speak the same language. And in some cases, it was just, they came at these songs fresh because they weren't part of their culture necessarily.
Oh,
so
yeah.
that was really interesting too, right? That just the value of the intrinsic value of the music came out because it still resonated with them, even though they weren't necessarily their own carols or their own Christmas tunes, you know?
Oh, yeah. That's a very cool thing that I hadn't even thought about. But yeah, of course, they come at it without a whole lot of like emotional baggage or history.
Yeah, right. Because if you say, like you say, Frank in Willamette during the holiday season, well, all of a sudden you see holiday season and you see green and red and tinsel and, you know, all these things, and it conjures emotions in, you know, within you, which then you project onto your experience. We could leverage a lot of that for the North American users and players or the people within English-speaking countries. But this was interesting where we're actually making the content for that but the people, some of the people involved don't necessarily have that backdrop to work with, you know?
Yeah, that's very cool. One of the ones that I really enjoyed was O Tannenbaum, because you processed it with this really scratchy record sound. It sounds like mono. And it reminded me of one of our family's favorite albums growing up. It was by the Hollywood Bowl Symphony Orchestra, Carmen Dragon's Arrangements of Carols. And my parents bought it in the late 1950s. And we were still listening to it, scratches and all, in the 1980s. And it just, I don't know, like you said, it just called back all of that nostalgia.
Well, we went for that. Like, I worked with Robert Elhai on that. And even the actual orchestral arrangements of that, the string arrangements and the woodwinds and the, I mean, we looked at, I think it was Bing Crosby's version of that in particular. But we kind of just, you know, looked at it, thought, what could we add to it? What could make it interesting? Douglas Rogiers, who's the crooner on it, did a great job. And I knew, you know, once we filtered it and did the proper string arrangement and woodwinds and setting of it, that it would, you would totally think that you're there and it's totally legitimate. Most of that kind of historic is post-processed after the fact. So in Dead Rising, if you go to the pause menu, you'll actually hear a full range instrumental version of that O Tannenbaum track in the pause menu. So you'll get to hear the lush orchestration in the full dynamic range and the full frequency spectrum. Whereas for the soundtrack and for In the World on radios and stuff, it made more sense to go with that vinyl old school with little scratches and wow and flutter effects added to it.
Oh, Tannenbaum, oh, Tannenbaum.
About Frank's Big Package, because that is an amazingly just fun thing with the Capcom Heroes expansion and then the mini golf add-on. So it must have been a really fun project to work on.
Yeah, it was. I mean, like we said, Dead Rising 4 had come out a year ago, and then this was the release for PS4, where basically when it launched on the PS4, it came with all the DLC that had been released already prior to that and basically came as one full package. So the game was like any post-release content fixes or anything like that were done. So it's actually a much more complete and, I would say, realized game than the one from a year ago. But what was cool about the Capcom Hero stuff is it really was probably some of the most fun most of us have had working on the Dead Rising titles, just because, you know, we got to work with great IP characters from the Capcom catalog and just kind of add a whole other arcade layer to the Dead Rising experience and do it really well. Like the experience is actually very polished, and it's like we actually had fun playing it, because a lot of times you're developing something and sometimes you have the luxury of it being like extremely inspiring, but a lot of the times you just have deadlines where you're trying to hit and you're trying to get a product out the door to hit, you know, certain ship dates or whatnot. And then it's usually, you know, in the first day patch or later on that you actually get to that quality bar that you really wanted to hit. Whereas with Capcom Heroes, because there was a really stable game and even the soundtrack, like there was a lot, like such a good base already covered for Christmas and all the battle music and all the front end stuff, that it truly was a DLC experience that was just added a lot more. So for this one, I brought in a couple of different additional composers, which is great. A guy called Dubmood, he's out of Calais, he's out of Sweden, or living in France right now. But he has a whole, if you check him out online, he's got a whole, he runs his own boutique, awesome electronic kind of labels, but he specializes in like this 8-bit, but truly programmed 8-bit material. And so he's got a bunch of artists on his labels that do a lot of really cool 8-bit or kind of different styles of chip-inspired music, but with modern production. So he did a bunch of tracks. Traz Damji came back, who's a longtime collaborator on the Dead Rising series. He did a bunch. Jason Zaffrey is another great guy. He had done one or two tracks on Super Dead Rising 3, and he came back and added some more. Capcom Heroes leveraged what we had learned on Super Dead Rising 3, and on Golf, which is part of the big package for PS4 and its own DLC on DR4. Golf, we ended up bringing back music that we released for Super Dead Rising 3, but that most of the world had never heard, just because it was an exclusive DLC for the Xbox only. So what we decided to do for Golf was essentially pepper the whole world with a bunch of the tracks that were from that and that fit the context. So we created a bunch of new tracks, and then we also used some tracks that we had released earlier that hadn't been heard. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. to work on arcade stuff. It's like, how do you basically, you know, take killer modern production and bring in layers of arcade, but not so arcadey that on the nose that it distracts the player's kind of a fantastical experience. And it was a fine line trying to find that, right? We did tests earlier on with pure 8-bit, you know, very faithful renditions of stuff, whether they were kind of faithful SNES kind of things or very, you know, computer, old school computer gamey kind of stuff. And it just didn't feel right. It seemed to it was too strong in the sense that it drew so much attention to itself. Whereas when we, you know, and I told the artist and the composer, I said, you know, we need to treat this as you're producing a modern pop track or more like indie kind of like edgy pop track. And then we are layering in elements of, you know, whether it's arpeggiators or different chip sounds that you're using as different kind of gated rhythmic elements. We'll bring them in, but we're not going to lead with them. We're going to lead with just A, is it just a track that makes you want to just like kick butt? And B, if there's not enough of the you know, the arcadey elements, then we'll bring them in. And if there's too much, we'll just dial it back until we find that sweet spot.
And you really did, because you're right, it's more than chiptunes, but yet it doesn't go all the way back to the music that kind of Penderecki, really atonal sound from DR4 from last year. And when you were thinking about what to do about the music, did you get the idea for chiptunes and the early arcadey stuff just because it was the Capcom Heroes content?
Partially, yeah. Like I said, the Super Dead Rising 3 was already kind of our version 1 of that. We had kind of gone through that experience where we had taken a Dead Rising world, brought in a couple of characters, and kind of done like this multiplayer co-op experience where, you know, it was heavily music-driven stuff. So we had experienced that already. But what was different about this was we were bringing in actual Super Move elements from all those IPs into the Dead Rising 4 world. So you know, Frank will go around to like an arcade machine, and basically there's challenges throughout the world that you then, as you build up your levels and as you gain things, you unlock other costumes that you can put on as Frank. And so you could put on a Darkstalkers kind of thing, you could put Ryu's thing, you could put on basically all these different characters who have really over-the-top sound effect design, kind of, you think Street Fighter and that kind of stuff, where it's like very iconic, you know, you know, that kind of stuff. So that was really big and over the top. So we had to basically make sure that the music would drive things forward, because the challenges would last between 60 and 90 seconds. But there was many of them, and we just didn't have time or budget to address all the needs. So what we did is we broke, Devin, the audio lead, and myself looked at it, and we broke it down into basically, you know, at the end of the day, we can break this into action cues and chase cues, and action being kind of more melee style things. Even if you're working with projectiles or other stuff, at the end of the day, you're implicated in fighting something to reach your goal, versus the chase ones where you're being chased or you're chasing somebody else. So once we split those up, then I'd mapped out all the tempos, all the different keys. One thing that not a lot of people know is a lot of times in games, we, besides thinking of a soundtrack as a whole, whether you have a main theme that then you develop over time and you reiterate, it's really important to me that there is, I treat the whole soundtrack and the whole game experience as no different than a symphony or a concerto, where you're changing your tempos, and in our case in games, you're trying to lock in the tempo based on the footfall tempo of the player or what they're doing on screen. Sometimes if you go just two or three beats per minute too fast, your character that is a hero actually ends up being wimpier because your music is driving it rather than, and he looks like a Luddite, or she looks like a Luddite, basically, like, because they're just a little too slow, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if you pull back the music a couple beats per minute lower, if you pull back the tempo just a bit less than their footfall cadence, all of a sudden they're like, wow, I feel invincible, you know? and then if you go like 10 beats per minute, it's just like, well, this just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And it's funny, Traz Damji and I, we talk about this a lot because Traz has spent years studying tempos and cataloging, going through the tempos of all the greatest hits of time and all the different things and keys. And it's really fascinating. We'll go through production and I intuitively feel like, oh, this track is, you know, around 140, 145. And then I'll call Traz. I'm like, okay, Traz, 140 or 141 or 143. And we literally will spend time going back and forth, looking at the animation captures from the game. And we'll bring in, like, say where we're doing a track, we're doing a work in progress. We'll bring up the track, we'll play it, and then in real time, we'll just change in our DAWs. We'll change basically the tempo up one, up two, down one, down three. And we'll spend a lot of time basically just finding the perfect tempo and the perfect key. So besides tempo, I also really, it's really important to me that, especially if we're working with multiple composers on a project, that, you know, if you listen to the soundtrack and it's sequenced a certain way, or it's, you know, if it's on Spotify and it's randomly played, that there is a interconnection harmonically between all the different tracks. Not necessarily chromatic. It's not like, you know, we have 12 cues and all the 12 notes on the keyboard we're going to map to to that. But making sure that at least the endings of songs and beginnings of songs, they can transition to any other one and it harmonically makes sense. And to the average listener, it's like, yeah, I get it, you know? So we map out not just the tempos, but I also map out the keys to give to other composers or for myself so that, A, we don't end up with too many songs that are in the key of D, or just to be like, what do they call it? The affect, right? You know, certain keys give a certain emotion.
Yeah, effect, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
So we do that, you know, I do that a lot in terms of knowing, like, okay, well, this one is like, you're like a god of, you know, gaming, you're this otherworldly character. And so we need to go drop C on this, or drop D, or drop B on this, or D flat, for example, is like a really evil sounding key if you're doing a lot of djent or like heavy guitar bass stuff, or like gothic kind of like industrial, like, I'm angry kind of music, right? You know, the key of D or D minor is like your classic Hans Zimmer wall to wall. Every cue in the whole soundtrack is in D because, to be honest with you, it's the easiest things for music editors to just basically, when they're changing the films right up to the last minute, they can take this cue from here to fill the gaps. If they were doing something where they had a bunch of different keys or a chromatic approach or a modal approach, they would not be able to hit their deadlines, essentially. So luckily in games, we have a bit more time in the development process where we can take time to map things out, really think carefully about, this track works with this character, this does not work with this same character in a different situation. And we're able to kind of iterate on that until we're happy. That was a long way of saying Capcom Heroes was truly a labor of love. And it's something that we're quite proud of in the sense of it really works and fits with what you see on screen.
It's so cool. It's really fun to watch when all of a sudden you get the Mega Man or Ryo. And were you able to incorporate their very specific themes into the mix too, just as kind of a reference or a throwback to?
Yeah, we did. In many cases, because there's different, you know, everybody has, like, if we say Mega Man, well, somebody could be thinking this Mega Man theme versus this, or this stage, they don't, or a character select screen song, right? They might associate that, not necessarily the actual theme for Mega Man X or whatever version. So what we ended up doing is I actually polled internally with different people within Capcom and even Capcom USA, and just getting a sense of like, okay, well, what are your favorite and most iconic themes for these characters, and what do you like? Send me your YouTube links and stuff. And I researched online different users and players and kind of looked at the legacy stuff. So in some cases where, you know, you would have an association with a character, but it actually wasn't a melody. It was just a guitar riff or a hook or a production approach. In those cases, we would try to mimic those production approaches, or like Zangief, I think, was one of them. I had done a version of Zangief's theme for Super DR3, which is your classic Russian balalaika kind of, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, that kind of a, obviously with synths, but that kind of harmonically, that was the thing. But I didn't know that there was a big contingent of people who associated Zangief with like this bass riff groove thing of a total different level in a total different game. And so what we did is I looked at the shape, the rhythmic shape of that, and basically said, take this shape, this is the key, this is that we're working within. I'm going to give you a melody here, or like a, you know, a trajectory for you to go on, and basically just make sure, whatever you do, make sure you preserve that rhythmic, well, it's like a rhythmic leitmotif, but it's basically just a riff that's recognizable, right? It's kind of like da-da-da-da, but instead of having the tonal notes of da-da-da-da, it's just da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, right? You can kind of, for most people, if I did it properly, you would be able to know that that's Beethoven, right?
Right. Well, I did.
Right. But so that's kind of what the process was. Sometimes it was a literal ad verbatim interpretation of the theme in a modern production context. Other times it was like, you know what, let's take this, but only use the first three or four notes of that melody so that there's subliminally a connection to the past, but then let's take it in a new direction. And then there's other times where there wasn't really any strong material, so we just created new stuff.
Wow, that sounds like so much fun. And when we talked earlier, you described what it was like to build basically an engine to implement the music for DR4 and really like granular level, with being able to shift cues and tempos and feeling. And now that that's in place, did that make it easier to put this soundtrack together?
It did, definitely. We didn't really leverage a ton of it, to be honest with you. Two things. One is, as soon as you start working with synthesizers and you're using very strong melodic material and harmonic material or chromatic material, you know, if you're working within the MIDI domain, then that would have been a whole other ball game, and it would have been much, much easier. But in this case, because we were going after polished, like really high-end production value, as soon as you have that as your focus, then your ability to decompose that into an interactive system is constrained, because you can't. It's kind of like saying, okay, great, I have all the multi-track stems from this great, awesome pop song. Now, without having that $500,000 mixing desk and all the plugins that were from that original session that made it sound so great, plus a mastering engineer pass on it, I want you to essentially just feed it into the system, and it's magically going to sound like that, you know, Grammy Award winning sound that you remember. It's just not possible right now. I'd say probably 5-10 years from now, we'll probably be there. But for now, we're just not there. We can run some plugins and we can run some stuff, but the complexity that goes into shaping a really top-notch track nowadays, it's still, you need the horsepower offline to do that. And I made the call, and I think it was the right one, to focus on that polish and product sound, that really heavy produce sound rather than making it like uber interactive, because most of the interactions for these challenges were still 60 to 90 seconds, right? They weren't, or sometimes a minute and 20.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It felt like there was more value in just making the player feel like they were invincible rather than patting myself on the back because Devin and I designed some interactive system that adapted to it, you know? And that's my job often, is basically making an executive call on like the true value lies in this, thinking from the gamer's perspective rather than just, aha, we did this. Aren't we great? You know, but it actually falls flat. It's kind of like academia, right? It's like, you know, you can write as many pages as you want with as many footnotes as you want, but if nobody's going to read it, you know, if the tree falls in the forest, did it make a sound? I don't know.
Well, and the ultimate goal is to make it fun to play.
Yeah. And this stuff, like it was, the gameplay was so much fun. It's like the last thing you wanted to do was to essentially hold it back. You wanted to catapult it, you know, and that was the job of the music on Capcom Heroes and Puzzle Fighter. It's the same thing. It's basically, you know, the music's there to catapult your experience, because you might only sit down and do a couch co-op kind of thing for 5 minutes, but you want to make sure that 5 minutes is a lot of fun, you know?
Yeah, and Puzzle Fighter is a lot of fun. I've been playing it. I've been spending time with it. And, you know, once you get the hang of the mechanics and stuff, it's really intense. And one of the things that I was wondering about is, because players do spend, or potentially a really short time playing the game, what sort of decisions did you make to make the music fun for them and give them a fun experience?
You know, it's an interesting dilemma, because mobile definitely is a different approach than traditional console stuff. Oh, by the way, we hit 1 million users on Puzzle Fighter.
Hey, so, congratulations.
Yeah, and we haven't even launched in some of the bigger markets like Japan and in China. So we're quite excited about that. What was interesting about the Puzzle Fighter is it, as a mobile game, you have to think that players... I mean, I to be honest with you, I look at my boys, like, it was the first game that, except for the bigs and the baseball games that I worked with, where I could let my kids play. So that was kind of fun, right? Coming home and it was very informing for me, because I have a 10, 12, and a 14-year-old, and my 10-year-old's probably the most prolific gamer, and I was like, hey, go to the Apple Store. Download Puzzle Fighter. And so he downloaded it, he watched it, and then he got it. Like within like 15 seconds, he pretty much knew exactly what to do. But it was interesting, because all of a sudden I could tell by, like, did he have a grin on his face or was he just annoyed? And I could tell about, you know, after he played his first round, he didn't stop. He's like, he wanted to level up again after the training tutorials and stuff. And I started seeing a grin on his face, and he's like, and he turns to me, he's like, Dad, it's a little addictive. I'm like, all right, you know, job well done. And then obviously, you know, being a responsible father, I'm like, well, son, the monetization schemes that they have going here, you know, make sure they don't take advantage of you. You know, that kind of a thing. But it's interesting, because it's such a wide range of a demographic that's going to be playing the game. And they could be in Japan on a long 2-hour commute to work on a speed train. Right. So they could have that, and they could be listening to Spotify while they're playing the game. So there's that aspect we have to consider. Then there's the, you know, I could be sitting at home on my phone or on iPad and playing against, you know, a friend who's also at home on the couch playing. And we could be at it for like an hour. And so the music basically had to be exciting enough, have both a low intensity and a high intensity, so that we could switch accordingly whenever you hit a threshold of, like, if the game was starting to become much more intense, we wanted to be able to support that. But it also had to be have enough changes and micro changes within the queue itself that it did not become annoying, and you wouldn't know where you were in the queue at any point.
And again, because it's filled with callbacks to all of these iconic Capcom characters, you were also able to incorporate themes for them too, again, like with Mega Man and Okami. I love that one. That was really cool.
Yes, great tracks.
Yeah, and even Frank from Dead Rising, he's in there.
Yes, he is. Yeah. So, I mean, we did. I would say probably 80% at this point, because it's an ongoing product, right? So we're still developing for it. We did, I think, 80% new versions of old songs, and then 20% was actually just brand new, non-associated with an IP songs, right? So that we had a couple of training levels and things like that. So that was fun, right? To be able to work within that sonic world that's already established. And then we develop our own versions of what would be the next iconic tune or the next great driving track.
Yeah, no, it's neat. And you mentioned before we started rolling here that Puzzle Fighter isn't done. It's going to...
No, it's ongoing. Yeah, it's ongoing, which is, it's an interesting process for us because we've, at Capcom Vancouver, haven't had any games as a service division, right? So I personally, I think it's awesome that every day we can tell what users, what levels they're playing, how many there are. We can look at all the telemetry and all the feedback essentially coming from the users, and doing things like Twitch streams or other things, actually get feedback from the users of what they're enjoying and which levels they, of your Capcom heroes, which ones would you like to hear next, you know? And it's pretty cool. It's different than a siloed AAA traditional console development approach, because you are having constant feedback, you're iterating constantly, and you're trying to keep your users engaged with the product, right? So, I mean, there's a business side to it as well, which is interesting. It's a whole different field, because there's user acquisition, which is a large part of it. You want to have retention, and to be honest with you, totally transparent, there's sides of it, of that industry, which I struggle with, particularly on the addiction side, because in order to make it sustainable, or the business model, they not that they want to have you addicted, but they want to make it so that you come back and want more. And I get that totally from a business side. But I even said at one point to our lead designers, and I'm like, I need to see the numbers on your design and what we're going to be doing in terms of, you know, what the rollout plan of the monetization and how you're doing it and stuff. I said, because if we're going to be kind of prepping people neurologically to like come back, and kind of like the Pavlov dog effect, I want music to temper that. It is a necessity as a business, and games as a service, or that whole mobile game development, I understand it, because the other flip side is it feeds a lot of people's families, and there's nothing, that's awesome, right? But on the flip side, when I look at my sons playing it, I'm like, you know, as a father, I'm like, okay, we got to temper this. There's got to be balance in our approach to it as developers, but also as consumers, so that our engagement with it, we don't get so addicted and so hooked on it that it actually clouds the rest of our life. And we can actually enjoy gaming more if there is balance, right? So that's tricky, right? You want to add value to your product and be mindful of the end user. And you want to have integrity in what you do. But it's a fine line, you know? Fine line.
Yeah, and I think it's something a lot of developers are wrestling with. And no one's really got the actual perfect solution yet. So it's kind of evolving still. And
we need people like you to keep us in check.
Right?
You're like, hey, Alexa, yeah, that track you did. Yeah, nice try. No, you didn't get me, you know?
Okay, I'll be more critical then. But
I just wanted to bring that up, because it's, in traditional console gaming, you don't really, I mean, the executive producers and the marketing teams, they deal with the bottom line and the return on investment side of it. And a lot of gamers don't understand the business side, which does affect game decisions and what gets made in terms of things that are cut, things that are features that are then developed. But on the mobile side, for Puzzle Fighter, for example, because it's an ongoing and it's a highly iterative thing, it's like a new frontier. I mean, it's been around for quite a few years now, and you have your big players, but we really don't know the effects of what this kind of a cycle, this feedback loop cycle is, where you keep coming back to a product over and over. And we're not talking like every Christmas you come back and play it. It's like, no, these are designed to be like habit-inducing extensions of your life, right? So So I take that really seriously and want to make sure that, like I said, that the whatever we can do to help enrich them along that experience and add some value, actual value to their life, that's really important to me.
Yeah, it is. Well, and you've mentioned, you know, being able to watch your sons play a game now that you've done, which is a new experience. And you've mentioned that one of your biggest challenges, like life challenges, is balancing family life with your job as music director at Capcom Vancouver. And, you know, that's something we're all trying to figure out. But I'm sure as a composer who has to be like creative on demand, it must be really challenging. And so I'm kind of wondering, what are some strategies that you found that really work for you?
There's a bunch of different ways we could talk about this. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't have anything figured out. My kids and my wife will be the first ones to tell you that we live with a freak sometimes. But when I did my master's dissertation because I have a master's in filmmaking as well, and part of my dissertation was on this notion of sketching, like film sketching. And one of the guys that I read and quoted extensively was Mikhail, I can't even know how to pronounce his last name, but he basically, flow and the psychology of flow was something that he discussed a lot. He analyzed, like, I don't know, 400 or 500 people that were successful artists and creatives around the world. And he kind of broke down what it was that allowed them to reach the success that they had continually, like not just 1 year and have a rare hit, but a decade later or 2 decades or 3 decades later to still be consistently having solid output. And he talked about this ability to have at the same time the ability to have a macro perspective and a micro perspective of whatever you're working on. So the ability to step back, literally, like if you're here and you step and imagine that you're floating above your body and you take a bird's eye view and look down at what you're doing to gain kind of a broader perspective. So for me, for example, if it's Capcom games or whatever stuff we're working on, you know, if I'm writing a piece of music for a boss battle or something or producing or doing a bunch of stuff, I need to take a step back and think like, okay, let's just be realistic about this. This game is going to come out. There's going to be X hundreds of thousands or millions of people that are going to play this game. Most of them are only going to play the first 20% of the game. Only about a certain percentage will go to the end. So I should then spend most of my effort on the front end of the game. For the mobile stuff, an example of that would be is, hey, take a step away back. My son is going to be playing this game and should I choose to go darker with that music or should I choose to go a bit more fun and light with it, but give it a bit of a production edge so it doesn't feel like it's really young kids music, right? So those are examples of in the production world, stepping back and taking a look. On a personal side, a couple of things. One, you know, really be present in the moment, you know, whether that's mindfulness, you know, or whatever it is, or if it's literally, you know, if I'm having, because I have so many different projects or things that I'm involved with, it's very easy to lose focus or to get overwhelmed by those things and become anxious or nervous or get stressed. And that's very counterproductive. So I actually have a counselor that I see often once, you know, every 2-3 weeks. I'll just go for an hour and just talk through stuff. And we talk about personal struggles. We talk about like professional struggles, other things. But that's been a huge, huge help for me personally. Because sometimes when you're so busy in production or other things, if you can take a step back, it's another way of decompressing and another way to have a macro perspective and gain another point of view that you don't necessarily have. So I would say that's been very helpful for me. Trying, if I can, at least once or twice a day to be mindful for a couple of minutes. And that could be as simple as I'm driving to Capcom or I'm driving to a meeting somewhere and whatever I'm doing for that 2 minutes, I only focus on that. So for me, because my mind races too much, I'm like, okay, for the next 2 minutes, I'm just going to look at all the wheels on the cars and the vehicles in front of me. And if my mind wanders to something else, I'm going to bring it back to just looking at those wheels for those 2 minutes. And all of that exercise is just to allow the rest of the noise of my product demands or my work demands or family demands to just stop and to be able to basically neurologically bring it back to a good place basically so that as I do that, I think it's like 6 or 8 months after the fact, but it's retraining your brain to be able to focus and to be able to focus on one thing at a time and have that ability to go from macro to a micro perspective very quickly.
Wow, that is super helpful because I have a tough time too, kind of putting things in boxes and setting them aside. I mean, I feel like I'm always mulling something over.
Yeah, no, and the only reason I brought that as an example is A, it's a real struggle to do that, but it's really important to do that because otherwise, for me, for example, I have a very sensitive nervous system, which obviously helps me be extremely sensitive for creative stuff, but it also makes me prone to a lot of other stuff. And I find that in order to be working optimally, I need to be able to get out all my thoughts, but also be able to shut them off when I need to, because otherwise, like right now, I'm talking to Kate. I want to get to know Kate and I want to know what she's doing and I want to know, you know, okay, if she has an audience, what do they want to know? But at the same time, I might never get a chance to talk to Kate again or her audience. So I improvised and I was like, okay, well, I'll go personal and I'll share some of that as a way to connect to the audience. So I try to do that constantly in any relationship that I have, and or people ask all the time, oh, like people send emails to Capcom or to me personally or try to reach out via other things. I literally listen to every single thing people send in. I don't always respond because there's a certain weight to having to manage that I just can't afford. But I try to view every encounter. I try is the operative word. I don't always succeed, but I try to, whether it's an interview or just meeting a stranger, working with a new musician, working with a game designer, I try to make those encounters, like, again, trying to be in the moment and actually going deep with whatever. Sometimes you can, sometimes it's just, you know, you're passing by somebody and you can't go really deep with somebody, but to the degree that I can, I try to be present there. The challenge, and getting to your original question, is how do I balance that with my family life? It's uber, uber hard because I find it easier to be present often with other people and not the people that are closest to me. So I, for example, try to once a month take each of my kids out for a date for an hour where I just give them undivided attention for that hour. And that was just, again, my counselor just recommended, hey, like if you're having a hard time balancing all the demands of your work and your family life and everything else, just schedule it out. Schedule your every single day, every hour of your day, schedule it out. Other things might come and like push them out of the way. But if you schedule your time, it's going to actually train your brain to shut off all the other things because you know you don't have to stress about all those windows that are open because you already scheduled stuff out. And then by scheduling your time out, you're already creating a hierarchy or like a priority, or like you're prioritizing what's important to you, right? So you put the hardest thing that you're going to try to get done during the day, you make that the very first thing that you do in the morning, which is hard for me because I'm a total procrastinator.
I
I wait till the last minute and then I have inspiration. For me is very easy. It comes like turn on the tap and it's there, but that's not that great when you have big deadlines. So I'm still struggling trying to start off the day with the hardest thing that it needs to get done, start with that, and then kind of map out the day. So the last three things, I'm just going to wrap up. One, if you can, go to sleep before 10 or 11 p.m. and then so that you get solid, healthy sleeping hours between 10 and 2 or 10 and 4 a.m. It's much better. And I've learned the hard way. I used to moonlight on films and other stuff really late till, you know, writing till 5 in the morning. But it's actually better to go to sleep by 10 or 10:30 or 11, get those healing hours of sleep between then and like 2 a.m. or 4 a.m., and then get up at 4 or 5 a.m. Then to stay up all night till 4 a.m. and then sleep in until 2 p.m. Your body actually is much better with the former than the latter. Two, drink a bunch of water. At least if you can, take your weight and have it in ounces and have that. So for me, it's like 3 to 4 liters of water a day if I can. And then three, just take time out to breathe and just relax and have fun.
Wow. Those are all, I mean, they're applicable to so many of us who have really stressful jobs and stressful home lives or home. What causes the stress is that you're not spending enough time with the people at home. But that's all just really, really wonderful things to think about and things that I think will be like really helpful. So I really appreciate that. And I appreciate how, you know, honest you've been with, you know, the challenges, because it's got to be tough. But it sounds like you have worked out, at least on paper.
Well, I wouldn't say I've worked it out as much as it's a work in progress.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't have it all figured out. I mean, I'm still trying to figure stuff out, particularly with the kids. For anybody who's in game development and has kids, it's hard. Like, you know, especially when you're working on either an independent studio or an up and coming studio, or you're working on bigger properties, like putting in 100-hour weeks, it's like, say goodbye to your marriage, or say goodbye to, you know, like, it's so, just the stress of game development, just from that perspective alone, is like, I don't know. I personally think that the game industry should be investing a lot more in counseling and like supporting people during those, you know, because if they're going to be expecting to have the cultural capital output of its employees to service some big blockbuster title just so they could reach a Metacritic, there's a cost to that, and that's like literally lost lives or lost marriages or relationships that are killed and stuff. So with kids, you know, so these are things which are important to, you know, when I'm at work at Capcom, I try to make sure we bring back reality, because it's easy as game developers for us to lose sight of like what is real when you're so enamored or you're so implicated in something that is very inspiring and fantastical. You have to temper it with what is real and what is right in front of me right now, because that ultimately is the only thing that's real, you know?
Yeah. And well, and you do get out of the game world from time to time, because you've got this wonderful film score for Kayak to Clem 2, which is just beautiful. It tells the story of a young woman who's traveling the Inside Passage to make a point, make a statement about native lands that are going to be developed. And how did that project come about? And what was it about this film that really spoke to you that made you want to do the music?
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. Worked with Zoe Hopkins. She's a First Nations film director, I think from Six Nations out of Ontario. And it was her first feature. And then Daniel Beckerman, he's an awesome film producer out of Toronto, with Scythia Films. He's kind of quite involved in Toronto International Film Festival. Basically, I had stayed in touch with Daniel Beckerman through my agent. I wanted to work with Daniel on stuff because he's one of those producers who he service produces his different Hollywood films or like mid-tier studio films, but that also develops his own films. And he's one of those producers where he takes projects that actually have a lot of meaning and that try to change the world for the better. And this was one of those projects basically that came up. So I took a look at what he had in progress. And then because of my experience working for over a decade at least with Inuit filmmakers, I worked on Atanajwat, The Fast Runner, and a bunch of different films with Azuma Productions out of Montreal and Nunavut. I'm always drawn to working with First Nations artists or you know, people that – cultures essentially that have a lot of history and a lot of depth and stories that haven't been told that need to be shared at large. So I just reached out to Daniel, said, hey, love to – if you haven't found a composer, I'd love to work on it. And it was a smaller film in the sense of it had a micro budget and stuff. So it ended up being a real labor of love. But it felt like the story that was being told was very personal. It touched on some of the ecological kind of challenges that we're facing now with protecting our waters, protecting our green spaces and stuff like that. So that was also of interest to me. And it was a road trip film, but on water in a kayak and in a comedy as well. So yeah, it just felt like it was a good fit. And once I got into it and started working with Zoe and started looking at the footage and the scenes that were coming together, it was a lot of fun. Particularly the end credits cue, I really enjoyed because I love playing guitar.
Oh, that was you?
Yeah. I did all the score. Yeah, so that was me. That one particular cue, I did drop tuning as well. So it's a lot of fun where you can just tune a guitar, detune it, and drop tune it in different, you know. So drop tuning is just either you drop your lower string much lower. Hold on. Give me one sec. Okay, so I have a guitar here. that's like an E chord. This is like a D chord. So guitar usually have E, A, D, G, B, and E. But drop tuning, and this is a lot of fun for anybody who doesn't even play guitar but wants to like feel awesome. All you need to do is take the bottom string and drop it. So we went from an E to a D there. So now instead of matching the top string, I'm matching the fourth string or the third string. So now anything I do on the bottom and the third string, it's an octave spread, so it's moving together. If I play the first three strings, doesn't that sound nice and open? And then your fourth string, right? So all of a sudden you have like a drone. So you have this drone on the bottom, and you can just do. So a lot of traditional music, they'll have stuff where you have like an e-sone or a drone. So you have a bunch of people humming like a, and then you'll have like a lead line on top, essentially doing a monodal kind of melismatic line on top. For the guitar or stringed instruments like that, what's great about drop tuning, I could even drop it further. So now I can actually take my fourth string. So now, all of a sudden, anybody can. I'm doing like power chords and I'm not even doing anything. I'm just playing those strings. So anybody who doesn't even play guitar, all of a sudden, it's really fun. So you can take stuff like a slide. Or take a beer bottle if you're drinking beer. And just bring it, and you're having fun. You can take another step further and drop your fifth string. So now we got. So that doesn't sound right. Something's sticking out. So now, if you're a guitar player, you have all these preconceived notions of like, oh, I got to use my fingers here and do it here. But essentially, you're just hacking what you know, and you focus on creativity. So all of a sudden, that same piece that I just played before. So just that change of me detuning helps me take the figure that I did before and interpret it in a totally different way. And it's cool because it basically, you notice right away, like the light bulb goes off, like, and you get it. You can get inspired to just try anything. So, right now, the sixth string, the final one. Maybe instead of going down, I go up. So now I'm doing is strumming this guitar, and it's a beautiful chord. So that in a nutshell is kind of, it's one easy way for people who aren't musicians. You might not be able to play, kind of use both hands like I just did, but there's nothing stopping from a non-musical person from picking up a stringed instrument, detuning it, and being inspired by it.
That's amazing. As soon as I get home, I'm going to get out my husband's guitar and try that.
And I only shared that just because it's like, you know, we do these interviews and we talk. And at the end of the day, if it doesn't make you go out and do something, then I question the value, right? Whereas if somebody could leave from this interview and have some takeaways where they're like, they hack their habits.
Yeah. You know. Yeah.
Why not, right? And especially if it actually enriches their life or enriches other people's lives. So yeah. And if anybody has any more hacks that will help me, please let me know.
Yeah, yeah. How can they get in touch with you? You're on Twitter and Facebook, right?
Yeah, Twitter and Facebook is probably the best way to get in touch. Unfortunately, email is just one of those things which I just can't get inundated with stuff. But if it's Capcom-specific stuff, just go to the CapcomVancouver.com website. I think there's a contact page. And any direct messages that you have, they send directly to me. If it's for me personally, my website is tendershoot.com, and you can just reach out to me via Twitter and or there, and or LinkedIn as well.
That's awesome. Oh, Alexa, this has been so much fun. I've really enjoyed talking with you, and I really appreciate how, you know, honest you were and how much you shared about just the whole process and what it's like, you know, what your life is like as a composer.
My wife will probably come back and be like, oh, Alexa, you shared too much. The kids nowadays is like, Dad, TMI or whatever, right? They're like, too much, right?
Yeah. Well, thanks so much. I really, really had a great time talking with you.
My pleasure, and have a great Christmas.
Thanks. You too. Thank you.